WQIW here. Sorry I'm late. This is the TechNet, believe it or not, even though we're starting kind of late. Amateurs gather at this time to discuss their favorite subject. You don't have to sign in if you're just listening. And if a person does have a question or a comment, would like to have that addressed at the TechNet, I'm going to have you guys sign in about a minute. Usual procedure, just to get my usual starting monologue, is that for the first hour we discuss people's questions and comments. At the end of that hour, John goes to the mailbag for those who don't yet have the ham license and don't have a way of addressing us directly on the air. They can do that by sending to John either an email or to or a snail mail. After that, Paul, WS2N, will tell us what's been going on in space, and he's going to have some awful nice things to say about the new Mars Science Laboratory, better known as Curiosity, that landed on Mars. After that, we go into deeper subjects. So at this time, why don't you give me your call letters and name if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
WA2PJS Vito Bayshore, yes.
KB2MAR Gabe, yes.
And to examine off the pole.
Okay, we've got Vito, we've got Gabe, and Wes. Anyone else? Just check in with the call letters of their name. Check in with their name and call letters. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
WS2N Paul with the Space Report.
We got you, Paul. And anyone else?
This is AC2IS Bill.
Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra, I think it is. We got you, Bill. Anyone else?
KC2WGV. Some info from the mailbag.
Glad to hear that, John. Okay. We got John. And one last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet because they do have a question or comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
This is KD2CAP. My name is Brendan with a question.
Okay. Brendan, I think it is. Kilo Delta 2. Please give me the call letters again.
Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Alpha Papa.
Okay, and I think that was Brandon. And if I got that correct, make sure I got the name correct. That is Brandon. Is that true, Charlie? Here we go. KD2CAP.
Yes, the name is Brandon. B-R-E-N-D-A-N.
We got you. All righty. I think we got more than enough people to start. Vito, haven't heard from you in a long time. That's a joke. Vito, glad to check. You're checking in, and go right ahead with your question. WA2PJF K2RIW.
Good evening, Professor. Happy to hear from you again. It's been a very, very long time, as you had mentioned. Another question in reference to the date of December 21st. Other material, another scenario I have encountered, and I've been reading about this, and various individuals have been talking to me about it, but I still don't understand exactly what they're referring to. Let me drop. Rumor has it that on that particular date, polar shift and polar reversal, North Pole will change to the South Pole, will take place. The Earth will shift, actually it says the Earth will change or start rotating in the opposite direction, with a huge disaster of unknown proportions. I did read this. Just curious as to what is happening here. Any information on this? Back to you.
Yeah, there's lots and lots of theories about the end of the world because of the end of the Mayan calendar and other kinds of not very well-founded predictions. Let's talk about each one of those things that you just mentioned one at a time. The Earth is an extremely heavy object. I don't think I've got to tell you that, Vito. It's got an extreme amount of what's called moment of inertia, and it rotates with reference to the sun once for 24 hours. It's been doing that for zillions of years. To take something that heavy, that's spinning, and to have it suddenly stop and spin in the other direction is just about out of the question. If mankind used every bit of resources we got to try to cause that to happen, we couldn't even put a dent into Earth rotation, if you know what I mean. So that's really out of the question from my point of view. I'm not an expert on this, but as you do more and more reading, I think you're going to find out if you go to good references. Let me drop.
Comment.
That the Earth rotating in some other direction is not likely. Alignment of the planets doing something funny is very unlikely. Sounds like you're reading what I call sensationalistic material, Vito. Wes, what have you heard along these lines? N2XJN, K2LAW.
Yeah, N2XJN, I agree with you 100%. I believe it's not going to happen, and there is no chance to do it. But for curiosity of the listeners, I can say, Newton said once, give me point of reference, and I'm going to move the Earth. I wonder if you could know that very much famous phrase, and you can reword it from English into American. And to make sure.
It was Archimedes.
No. That was Newton. He was referring to Archimedes, but it was Newton.
And no matter who said it, it's just an example that's kind of a ridiculous example. Yes, if you use a lever arm, you've got a point of pivot, sort of like a seesaw, and you've got a lever arm, and one end of the lever arm is very short because you want to lift up a rock, and you've got a strong enough pivot very close by, and this very long lever arm, you apply pressure to the long arm. The ratio of the arms is the ratio of the forces. If the ratio of the arms is 10 to 1, and I apply 10 pounds of force on the long arm, I can get 100 pounds of force on the short arm. That's sort of what was being said with that. And yes, it was taken to the ridiculous example of if the arm is long enough, I can move the Earth. Well, where's that arm going to be that's long enough between Earth and something else? Where's the pivot point going to be? There's no easy way of taking it to that extreme. It's an interesting set of wording, but you can't really do that. What's the name of the source of the information that you're reading, Vito? In other words, is it a book, a magazine, a radio program, a television program? Where is the source of information that you're now referring to, Vito? W2PJF, K2RIW.
I have a comment for Vito also.
Okay, yeah, John. Vito first.
Okay, it's going to sound ridiculous, and please don't laugh, but there's an individual that I work with at the Home Depot, which I'm only there one day a week, who is quite in depth, I do believe, in this topic. And we do have our, exchanging of thoughts and ideas in reference to this particular issue. And he had made mention about the things I had said. So, before I even dared to come to you with this, I did go up on the internet and did type in the North and South Poles changing. And the first paragraph of many paragraphs was exactly as I had read to you. And this information I passed along. This is where it came from so far. And also we have John as a comment. Back to you.
Yeah, the Earth has reversed its magnetic field a number of times in the past, and it's probably going to do it again. It's not a earth-shattering situation, and I, for one, hope that when it does do the next reversal, and I think it's something that takes place over a significant number of thousands of years. I hope that the reversal takes place by which the poles migrate from north to south, as opposed to literally going through zero first, because with zero magnetic field, we would have a problem of the Van Allen belt, and the protection that that Earth magnetic field gives us would be absent for a period of time. Those charged particles coming out of the sun, called the solar wind, get deflected by our Earth's external magnetic field, and those particles end up moving along those magnetic lines, and those magnetic lines do touch the Earth at the North Pole and the South Pole, and that's where the particles are allowed to re-enter the atmosphere, and therefore, at those locations, at those times, you do see the aurora borealis and aurora australis, I think it's pronounced. Let me drop.
Yeah, I got a question. N2 Mike Bravo.
N2 MB recognized. That's Barry. That Earth magnetic field reversal, when it does take place, if it does take place in our lifetime, I'm a little skeptical of that, but it's some number of thousands of years, and we are moving in that direction. I believe the Earth's magnetic field is going through a weakening process and a possible reversal. So during the period of time, if it does go through zero, the normal protection we get from that magnetic field will be lessened, and that is something to be a little bit more concerned about, because that stands a chance of being a reality. Many of these other disaster predictions, as you can tell, I'm having quite a bit of trouble with. We're going to go to John and Barry in that order. John, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. No, Dick, you covered it. That's exactly what I was going to say. We've gone through the reversals many times over the life of the planet. I think this cycle is 20,000 years or 27,000 years. But over to you, Dick.
And to my knowledge, no one has ever associated the extinction periods with the magnetic field reversal. In other words, there have been massive extinctions a large number of years ago that took place on the Earth. And was that because of a meteorite impact at that time, or a global warming situation, or a nuclear winter situation because of a massive number of volcanoes? There's all kinds of predictions along these lines. But again, it's something that takes place over either thousands or millions of years. Barry, into Mike Bravo, K2RIW. Go ahead, Barry.
Further comment when you're ready from Vito.
Yeah, we're going to go back to you, Vito. Don't worry. Barry, you got it?
Okay, yeah. What I wanted to ask you was, I agree with everybody that we've had many shifts in the magnetic field. I wonder if geologists have figured out how many and how long the shift takes. I think through geology they probably could get all that information, certainly the last shift, how long it took for it to do that. And you made an interesting comment. You said that you hope that the magnetic pole shifts slowly. Why would it do that? I'm just curious. I'm back to net control and to Mike Bravo.
It's my hope that it does it by migrating as opposed to going through zero and coming back in the same location with the opposite polarity. I mean, how do you actually take what we now call the North Pole, magnetically speaking, and South Pole, and how do you reverse them? Well, in theory, they could go to zero, and what is now the North Pole becomes the South Pole, magnetically. That's one approach. The other approach is the North Pole slowly moves across the globe and shifts toward the South Pole, while the South Pole does the opposite. That migrating is a
tens of years.
Yeah, over a large number of years. What I worry about is if it does go to zero, I hope it goes to zero for a short period of time, because that's not good, because it is a major protection item. If we had zero magnetic field for a very long period of time, then those charged particles hit the Earth directly. They don't get deflected. The solar wind does do a little bit of peeling away of the atmosphere. I mean, Mars is believed to have had an atmosphere. It lost its magnetic field, and therefore the solar wind slowly peeled away that outside atmosphere is one theory of operation.
So physically possible for it to go to zero, or does it just have to keep moving around?
Okay, the mechanism by which that magnetic field is generated, I think, is only partially understood. Once every 11 years, the magnetic field of the sun, a very large object, that magnetic field reverses in polarity once every 11 years. It comes back to the same polarity 22 years later. So if something as massive as the sun, with all of its churning going on, can reverse its magnetic field, and what's really going on inside of the Earth and the churning that, that creates our magnetic field, I believe is only partially understood. So reversal has taken place. Geological records prove that. I'm not an expert on this. As you guys do a little bit more research, I think you'll find out how many times it has happened, how many years over which it has happened, and there may be even ways of predicting was the Earth's magnetic field equally as strong in each one of those cycles. But there are cycles of it, and how can it reverse? Well, it's sort of like saying, how does the sun do it? If the sun can do it, I know we can do it. Do we do it the same way? Do we do it the same rate? Lots and lots of questions there. Vito, when it comes to the reversal of the magnetic field, that one is not easy to completely deny. When it comes to stopping the Earth and rotating its rotation, changing its rotation, or to change its location with reference to our orbit around the sun, if anybody's making those kind of predictions, I think it's very, very unlikely. To me, to PJF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, of course. If the Earth were to stop for a moment, it would be more than likely very disastrous, I'm guessing. Anyway, I just had read that. And the last thing, real quick, the same individual whom I do converse with at the store had made mention, and we have been seeing this, that the weather conditions will become more severe and more so as we approach the date of 21. And you see yourself, the rain's been very, very heavy at times and so forth. Any truth would you guess to the weather conditions being more severe? And that's the end of my questions. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if the Earth's magnetic field does reverse, is the weather going to change? If it goes through zero, I suspect there would be some change there. How severe, I don't know. By the way, let me go back for a minute about Earth slowing down, stopping, and reversing. If you and I were standing at the equator, Vito, because you're on a object that's around 8,000 miles in diameter, a little bit less, you're 4,000 miles from the center, and it rotates once every 24 hours, you put that together, standing at the equator, you're moving roughly 1,000 miles an hour from west toward east because you're standing on something that's rotating. And so to take all of that mass of all of those objects, you and your automobile, the trees, the buildings, and everything else at the equator, you and I are now 40 degrees above the equator, so instead of moving 1,000 miles an hour, we're moving a cosine of 40 degrees times 1,000 miles an hour, and we're moving 700 miles an hour. Only a person at the North Pole and South Pole is not translating like that. He's only purely rotating. So to take the mass of all of those objects, moving at all of that speed, and suddenly stop it and reverse it, where does the energy come from to do that? So that's very, very unlikely. There's lots of disaster predictions. There's lots of people with lots of theories. And so we got to take this slowly. We got to find out how traceable to the Bureau is this information, if you know what I mean. The National Bureau of Standards, we used to call that the Bureau. Now it's called NIST. But is there real evidence that can be measured, can be verified, and so on? When it comes to geological evidence about magnetic field, I believe there is. Is the geologic evidence of the Earth ever...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The Earth ever stopping and reversing? No way in hell. Now, there's probably, if you search deep enough, geologic evidence that the Earth did rotate at a different speed. There's good reason to believe that the Earth turned a bit faster a large number of years ago because of the tides. The moon is slowly moving outward. I think it's about an inch a year. I don't know the exact numbers. Is it a centimeter? Is it an inch? Is it 3 centimeters? The Earth, the moon is slowly moving outward because of that energy of the moon coupling to our tides. The tides have a small amount of resistance to the Earth's rotation. So rotational energy of the Earth is being slowly coupled into the moon. If you study what happens with satellites, the graveyard is up. Whenever you put anything in geosynchronous orbit, roughly 22,000 miles away, and it rotates around the Earth in its orbit at the same rate that the Earth rotates, therefore it looks geostationary to you and I looking up at that satellite. Let me drop. And each one of those satellites, when they come to end of life, they use a little bit of positioning fuel they got left to put themselves into a higher orbit, because everything higher than that orbit slowly spirals outward. Everything lower than that orbit slowly spirals inward. That's because of the coupling effect between something in orbit around the Earth versus the Earth's rotation. So the moon is an object way beyond the geosynchronous orbit in altitude from us, roughly 240,000 miles away. That's more than 10 times the 22,000 miles that I'm talking about. So the moon is slowly moving outward. The Earth is slowing down because of that, very slightly. And if we look enough millions of years backwards, I am guessing the Earth used to turn once every 23 hours, once every 22 hours, numbers like that, instead of once every 24 hours. So by a very slow coupling process, yes, the Earth is slowing down. But I wouldn't worry about that one, because again, as you study it, it is an extremely slow, very predictable process. Anyone else have any further comments on all of the above? Give me a call that is right now. K2RYW in the TechNet.
WGB.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, one of Barry's points, interesting point. The detection they use, the magnetometers, and they go up in the mountains where these old rocks are, and they can determine that when that rock was formed, the magnetic direction was in whatever. The problem is, with continental drift and subduction, we can only get to particular rocks. We have not found any original rocks that go back to that time. Most of them have been subducted. So that's part of the limit when you're trying to find out how many times, because we can only go back so far. Back to you, Dick.
And a comment.
Yeah, there are places in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean where you're getting spreading taking place as opposed to subduction. And so the previous record is not being wiped out quite as rapidly as it is in places where subduction is taking place, where one chunk of land is folding under another chunk of land, and you're building up a mountain in that area. The spreading areas, I think, are where they can look at more of the past geologic records. That's the good news. The bad news, to do much investigation at the bottom of the ocean, it's a very difficult place to get to, so that's not easy research. Wes sounds like he's got something to add to this. Go ahead, Wes.
Just a quick question in regards to Vito's subject. I have never seen any example of the magnetic polarity being changed gradually. It simply doesn't exist in nature of any kind. So could you correct that? Now also, when Mars was cooling down, didn't create a significant magnetic polarity, then I would say is that we have something that is still circulating inside the core, but has ability to maintain the north and south, even though that is in not steady state. I mean, how do you picture that in the Earth? And to here.
You guys are giving me credit for knowledge I ain't got. I'm not an expert in this area and a lot of other areas. I'm a guy with a whole lot of opinions. Yes, the Earth does have a molten core of a metallic conductive-like substance, iron core, we call it. So the molten core and the rotation of that core is the usual explanation given for where does the Earth's magnetic field come from. And how does that happen? That ain't clear. Mars has done enough cooling that it might not have a molten core anymore, and that could be the reason why Mars no longer has a magnetic field. And that lack of that magnetic field is making life on Mars quite a bit more difficult, if not almost impossible, lately. Now, Mars, in its earlier days, there's a fair amount of evidence, and Curiosity is going to gather a hell of a lot more evidence about the past, water, present history, water being present on Mars, and probably a magnetic field being present on Mars in its earlier, in its earlier days. That molten core of the Earth is going to be molten for a long time to come, so we're going to have a magnetic field. By some process, it does reverse periodically. I don't understand how. All of us can do some more searching on this, on the assumption that there's good records for that. And so reversal, I think, does take place. And is it gradual or rapidly when it goes through zero and comes back out in the other polarity? I hope it's rapid. And I am guessing it takes place over thousands of years. So it's not something in our lifetime that's going to give us a great deal of grief, is my belief. But I'm not an expert in this area. Anyone else throw any comments? Give me a call. Let us K2RAW.
K2WS2N.
We got Eric and Paul in that order. KE2EJ. I hope that Nova and Nova Science Now has given us some information on this one, Eric. KE2EJ. K2RAW in the second half.
Actually, they have. There's a Nova, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago that covered the topic. But I wanted to point out that the where magnetic north is, it's constantly shifting. Okay, and that's part of the function of what's going on between the Earth's molten core and its crust. And the U.S. Geological Survey issues correction factors. Depending upon where you are, magnetic north shifts, and it changes over time. And I think they issue new directives every 3 years as to where things are pointed. And the FAA, I believe, has correction factors for airports. So it is fluid. It is not something that is constant all the time. K2RAW, K2JAX.
Very fine, Eric. Eric, you might want to know that your audio on that particular rig is about 7 or 8 dB lower than I think you would like it to be. Carrier was fine. Nice signal-to-noise ratio, but audio is kind of low on that particular rig. And yes, I have seen websites that will show you the past history of where the Earth's magnetic pole is, North Pole, for instance, is located each year. It moves some number of miles on the surface each year in sort of a circular pattern, a spiral-like pattern. And that magnetic pole is not aligned with the pole of rotation. In other words, the Earth rotates in a particular way around an axis, and the axis of the magnetic field is displaced from that. As such, depending where you're standing on the Earth, your compass doesn't give you true north, it gives you magnetic north. Where you and I stand right now, on Long Island, for instance, that change in magnetic field is around 12.5 degrees. So your compass is reading 12.5 degrees, I'm going to call it counterclockwise, as opposed to where true north is as far as your mapping is concerned. And as you go to different places on the continent, you're looking at that displacement in different ways. We see that displacement toward the west from here. The people in California see it toward the east. And there's a place in the United States in the center somewhere where the compass reads true north. So that's something to know about. I think it was John. No, it was Paul. WS2N? Tell us what you've been exposed to on this one, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
A little bit of that, but not much. On the reversals, and I believe Noah did have a show, The Magnetic Storm or something. I forget how they titled that. And they talked about 50,000, roughly every 50,000 years there's a general reversal. You know, it's not exactly 50,000, but in that area. And they said, about now, we should be experiencing that time frame. And when it does happen, it's a sudden shift. And, you know, I think there are a lot of signs that it's weakening now. And when this does happen, it's a pretty sudden shift, you know, over a matter of like a year or two, some bizarre number. It's a very, very short period of time, which, according to the show, would leave the Earth in that time frame opened up to all kinds of problems, you know, without the magnetic field. You're going to have, you know, no protection. Your ozone layer is going to go away. You won't have all the particles from the sun are going to be blasted in the Earth, and that type of problem. You'll have auroras all the way to the equator, that kind of thing. That was on maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Back to you, Dick.
So it looks like a PBS program called Nova had that. John, you watch on your television quite a few of the science stories, science channels, which I'm not getting because I don't have a satellite system. Do you remember seeing programs on this one, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Yes, Dick, exactly where I got the information of how difficult it is to tell because of the continental drift and orientation. You know, Pangaea was orientated one way, so now we have the continents not only moving but tilting. So how do you determine where that rock was, when it was formed, whether it be sedimentary or igneous? When it was formed, it was polarized in one direction, but then it was moved around. So they're really working hard on that. Paul may be right. It may be 50,000. I thought it was 27,000. But one question to you, Dick. Do you think that circular movement of the North Pole and the South Pole could be due to precession of the inner core?
That's a darn good guess. When you look at the past records of where was the North Pole over the last, let me say, 1,000 years, and that's reasonably well known, and how much it moves each year, it is a kind of a spiral. It's a random bug walk, like a mapping, so to speak, of where was the North Pole. This is in very far northern Canada is where it is right now, and it keeps shifting around a little bit, a small number of miles per year. And as I said, it's not all walking in one direction. It's kind of a random walk with a kind of a spiral-like to it. So is that due to precession? Precession is a word that not everybody understands. When you take your child's top and you spin it, and you've got it spinning at a particular rate, and you start off with the top straight up and down, and because everything is not perfect, the top eventually tilts a little bit over to one side. Because it tilts over to one side and gravity is pulling on the top, gravity wants the top to completely fold over so that its side is laying against the floor of your house, if you know what I mean. That force of pulling it off to one side and the gyroscopic action of the rotation of the top, when you put that together, the net result is something that's called precession. Let me drop. Which means the top wiggles around in a very characteristic manner. If you take your bicycle wheel, when you've got it removed from the bicycle, and you're holding on to the shaft, this is an English racer-type bicycle in my hand right now, I'll say, and I'm holding onto the shaft, and I'm holding onto the shaft on the left-hand side, and my hand is not touching it on the right-hand side. So I'm holding it a little bit off center as far as gravity is concerned. When the axis is parallel to the Earth and the plane of the wheel is perpendicular to the Earth, and I spin the wheel and I hold it by that axis with my finger, and you'll notice that the wheel moves around you, so to speak, in a characteristic manner. That's because you're giving it a disturbing force, because you're holding it not at the mass center, gravity is pulling on it, and because it's rotating, this force creates this precession action. There's lots of magnetic examples of how precession takes place. So is the Earth's magnetic field and the the churning of the core, the magnetic core, which appears to be the cause of that magnetic field, is it also going through a precession? And is that precession the explanation for where causing the North Pole to move on the map of the Earth? Yes, there's a good chance that's all happening that way. We got to do some more thinking on this one, more research on it, as I see it, Vito. So, although an awful lot of what your friend is saying has a sensationalistic quality to it, a certain percentage of it does have a degree of truth. That's what I think you're sensing. You know that the guy is not crazy. He's a guy who gets easily excited by this kind of material. That's why he's bringing it to your attention. And not every bit of it is off the wall, if you know what I mean, Vito. So I think it's about as far as we can go with it today. And many of us are going to be looking at more of this and reading more about it. And
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
One quick question to you, John. What is the name of that channel indoor program that has these science stories that you are very excited about or enjoy very much? What's the name of the channel and the name of that program? And the DVD that you mailed me recently, I think it came from that particular source. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Yes, Dick, that's one. A very good friend of mine takes care of me that way. That is, the one you have is Through the Wormhole, which is on, I think, its fourth season. And the other one that's extremely interesting is the one labeled The Universe. They're both on the same channel, and they switch. Sometimes it's on the Science Channel. Sometimes it's on Discovery Channel. So they may migrate to public TV. I'm not sure. But I know some of them have. And by the way, The Universe, I think it's season 6, is on the way to me.
Very well done. Yeah, this Through the Wormhole, narrated by Morgan Freeman. Very well done. And if you get a chance to listen to that, very nicely done on quite a number of astronomical subjects as well as science subjects that are
QEJ.
Science subjects that are investigating the human mind. One of the big mysteries in the world is where does consciousness come from? That is a tough one. Eric, I think you've got something further. Go ahead, KE2EJ, K2RAW.
K2RAW, KE2EJ. Just to let you know, Science Channel, Discovery Channel, all part of Discovery Communications. Actually, they get some of their stuff from PBS, not the other way around. And most of those shows are done very inexpensively, and sometimes when you do a little cross-checking, you find some of the info is not quite accurate. K2RAW, K2J.
And thank you very much, Eric. As you dig deep enough into what anything somebody says, when he talks enough, whether he's a presidential candidate or whether he's somebody that signs into the TechNet or somebody that runs a well-respected program on broadcast, everybody has a batting average that's never 1,000%. We all have a certain error rate. And the fact that you occasionally find an error in a particular program, don't let that influence you to thinking that, okay, the whole program, you shouldn't listen to it anymore because they make mistakes. To some degree, everybody makes a mistake. The next thing to worry about is what is their mistake rate. If they make mistakes 50% of the time, then it's kind of hard to listen to them and have faith in it. If they make a mistake one statement out of 1,000 or 10,000, then they're doing very, very well from my point of view. I've made some beautiful mistakes in my day. Guarantee it. Vito, interesting subject, and I think you're going to be bringing it back to us more, and we're going to be looking for more of it. Back to you for any final comments on this one, Vito. And it's a tough one to say completely yes or completely no. There's quite a bit of maybe on some of these, Vito. WA2PJF, K2RIW.
And I have an additional comment, Dick.
Vito for his final, and then we'll go over to John for his final. Go ahead, Vito.
Okay, very good. You've covered everything. Just a quick question for next week. I don't know if you're in this category to answer this type of question, but this is for next week. I've been reading about survival foods, and there's 37 special foods you're supposed to put away that I can't seem to get the answer as to what they are in preparation for anything that may come to pass in the near future. So just something to think about for next time if you have any information on that. And I will sign and thank you so much, and back to Net Control.
To be prepared for a disaster is a very good thing to do. To have the right amount of food, water, electrical batteries, radios, and whatever. When you get a hold of your September issue of QST Magazine, you're going to see an extremely well-written article. I wish I could remember the guy's call letters now. He's a Long Island ham. I should know him very well. I don't have that issue in front of me. I just read it very briefly last night, where he's describing what happened on 9/11. This is a guy who is an Aries, a Races member, who is very well-equipped. And he was at ground zero for three solid days just doing emergency radio communication. And he even had to make sure that no one knew where he was, because they weren't sure was this particular disaster scenario, was the terrorist organization, which hadn't yet been identified, was it going to be attempting to knock out the disaster centers, the communication centers that were carrying on the emergency communications. And so when you see a September issue of QST, very well-written article about how this particular person was prepared with his bag of radio equipment, with batteries, radios, antennas, and whatever, that he could go on a moment's notice, pick it up, and he transported himself from his usual emergency communication center in Long Island, and he went to one he had never been to before, so to speak, in New York City, very close to Ground Zero. Very good story, and I think you'll enjoy it. KC2WGB with some further comments. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, I just want to remind everybody, when you're watching those science shows, they're using particular models that we use now on the subjects. And sometimes they pick a model which is new or the information isn't all in, and they try to extrapolate on that. So keep in mind, they're just models that they're dealing with, because we really don't know. So, yeah, Eric is right. Some of it could be wrong. But they're well done, and those episodes look quite expensive, especially the graphics. So I don't think they're cheap. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
And many amateurs would like to be scientists. And the word science, from my point of view, is an evolving body of knowledge that tries to explain how things work and tries to be useful to mankind. And that evolving body of knowledge is continuously changing. Today's best scientific knowledge, most of the time, is better than yesterday's, but it's always changing. The whole darn planet, and everybody believed at one time that the Earth was the center of the universe. And boy, have we been humbled on that one. Five times in a row, and I think we're about to be, or four times in a row at least, we're about to be humbled the fifth time. The Earth is nowhere near the center of this particular universe, if you know what I mean. There's not only one universe. So everything slowly evolves as you gather more data, and there's no absolute truth, because you don't have absolute accuracy and the best possible theories. So again, there are people who lose faith in science because they sense that it is changing. It has to change. It has to evolve. We all are slowly changing. I mean, people get married assuming that, hey, I've married the perfect person, and she behaves exactly the way I want her to. This is from the male point of view. And you hope she's not going to change, and she hopes you're not going to change. Well, change is going to take place, and it's not always at the rate... not always at the rate you want, and it's not always from the cause that you want. Okay, Gabe was the next person with a question. KB2MAR. And I hope your question is an easier one to answer than that last one, Gabe. That last one, in my opinion, is a tough one. KB2MAR, you got it, Gabe. K2RIW.
Dick, on a quick one when you can.
Well, it was a late check-in.
Jim, we heard for a late check-in. Eric, I think you said you had another comment, and your audio sounds very nice now, Eric. Go ahead, Eric. I just want to open John's eyes a little bit as to what things cost. A typical episode of NOVA runs anywhere from $1 million to $1.5 million to $1.25 million. NOVA Science Now is about $100,000. Not spend more than $60,000 to $70,000. So that is why you'll see an increasing number of really nice-looking graphics. Because making graphics at New York Institute of Technology in Evanston, Sutherland, used to be like $20,000 to $30,000 a second. Kind of graphics, as far as all of it, and most of it is done with. Like Alias and other very, very expensive graphic programs that cost in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, with like Lightwave 3D or After Effects, we can do most of these amazing, amazing looking graphics for very inexpensive. So the cable companies really cannot spend more than $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 on an episode of that kind of stuff. So that's cheap in relation to things.
K2RIW, K2. 5, 5, 6, 6, 6.
Thank you for that information, Eric. It's obvious that it's not cheap. And what's the best way we can put it? Each one of those projects, somebody's got to have a good plan, some funding, and prove that he's going to have to his chain of command, return on investment, so to speak. Gabe, I'm going to be able to hear you on the input, even though we're getting some excess noise in there. So go right ahead with your question. KB2MAR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
My question concerns
KB2MAR, K2RIW. Yeah, we were discussing briefly last week. I was giving a little bit of a explanation back EMF and inductive reactants and capacitive reactants fall into this category. Every bit of the number of ohms that you ohms for that winding, and yet if I go sine wave through that choke, instead of it acting like 3 ohms, it might act like 3,000 ohms. And the difference between those two, we call it inductive reactance. That inductive reactance, you can plug it. Says, how in the world does it have what looks like resistance, which is called reactance, a resistance to AC, is different than a resistance to DC. A real coming out very nicely okay. I'm checking now. Okay, like all's well. Measure it at 1 megacycle, 60 hertz. That this real pure resistor. And this thing called a reactor, an inductor, has a greater number of ohms at a higher frequency. It's really due to back EMF. The current you put through that inductor creates a magnetic field. Creates what's on. What you're getting by Lenz's law and Faraday's law. And whether that
magnetic field is happening because a change in magnetic field is happening because.
Phenomenon, which we call inductive reactance. So
The nice thing about an inductor used as a filter network for a power supply is that the DC current flows through. That's what you want. The AC ripple coming from your half-wave or full-wave rectifier, most of that gets removed from the filter network, and therefore you get a nice, strong, steady DC coming out. And by way of inductors and capacitors, you do most of your filtering. And if you want filtering beyond that, electronic filtering can really help a whole lot. Modern day integrated circuits as a filtering network, as a voltage regulating network, can take out tremendous amounts of ripple. A well-designed voltage regulator circuit, as long as you have the right amount of DC voltage going into it, even with ripple, what comes out is rather smooth DC voltage, where almost all of the ripple has been taken out electronically because of the feedback mechanism of the operational amplifier-like performance of that voltage regulator. Maybe that helps some of it. I know you were only getting pieces of what I said before, but maybe a little bit more of it came through this time, Gabe. KB2MAR, K2LAW. KB2MAR, K2LAW. Are you there, Gabe?
Listen on the input.
KC2WGV.
Could you repeat that message, Eric? KE2EJ? KE2IW?
Yeah, I don't know if you're hearing him on the input, but he's, you should go in through your alternate input for the moment and listen on the input.
Roger, Dodger. Okay, Gabe, want to give it another try? KB2MAR, K2LAW.
Are you hearing him, Dick?
Right now, I think I am not, Eric. Are you hearing him on the input, Eric?
Yeah, I'm hearing him through one of my... hang on a second, guys.
Roger, Dodger. K2RAW testing.
It's going to take me another minute.
Well, stand by, Eric. KB2IW, KB2MAR. Richard, can you hear me now? KB2MAR, hearing you very well. So I know throughout those pieces, you only got pieces of the answer. Tell me how much you got and how much is left to be explained, Gabe. KB2MAR, K2LAW.
Okay, I got everything you said about the reactive components and things, the capacitor and all that kind of stuff that you were saying, and you were saying that the bridge rectifier, you really can't compare the two. But what I want to do now is have an AC unit, an air conditioner, that draws 10.2 amps. And what I want to know is what value of non-polarized capacitor should I put across that line? I was thinking I should put it in maybe in some kind of a breakout box near the floor, and then make a little rig it so it plug into the wall and all that kind of stuff. But what value capacitor should I use in order for that set up to work so that the it'll throw back power back into the system? If you know what I mean. K2RW, KB2MAR.
Okay, let me run back what you just told me. 10.2 amperes, you believe, is the current that's drawn by your air conditioner. And if that happens to be on a 220 line, that's quite a few kilowatts of input. And maybe it's a 20. What was that again, Gabe? You said it was 120?
QSL.
Okay. Now, you sound like you want to put a capacitor across the line of your air conditioner. And
many an air conditioner or refrigerator has a so-called starting capacitor on the motor circuit of the compressor unit, and that's entirely different. That capacitor that's part of the motor circuit has to have a very specific amount of capacitance in order to properly operate that motor. You said you want to put a capacitor across the line. What is your motivation for doing that, Gabe? Give me a few more words on that. KB2MAR, K2RIW.
Okay. A while back, I read someplace where that you could put a capacitor. Now, the thing was it directly on the compressor, or was it on the actual AC line going into the wall? I figured maybe it would be on the line going into the wall, because then you'd have to open up the unit and put another capacitor on the compressor itself, which is probably the best way to go. But like you're saying, you have to know the right value to put in there. I have no way of knowing. What I just told you wouldn't work. I wouldn't be able to get like a breakout box of some type and then put a capacitor in there. And this capacitor would throw power back into the system to make the AC unit use less power. Back to you.
Basically, what you're talking about is people of our supply, Capco from New York. We spoke about it with Glenn.
What I think we're confusing here, Gabe, is that if you and I were running a factory, and if we had a whole lot of inductive machinery, like punch presses and things like that, in the factory, and therefore our particular factory ran what's called a certain power factor. In other words, it would have an inductive load as far as Con Ed or LIPA is concerned. In that particular case, somewhere in your factory, you would put a bank of capacitors across the line in order to correct the power factor so that Con Ed or LIPA doesn't charge you a premium charge for your electricity. You, as a homeowner, do not have to do that. And even if you did, as a homeowner, do that, correct the power factor for your particular house. And by the way, the average house, let me drop. The average house, with rare exception, has a power factor that's nowhere near as bad as you would get in a factory. I mean, the light bulbs in the house, the television set, a whole lot of other things are not creating a significant power factor. Yes, your air conditioner might be, but it's not enough that you need correcting. And even if you did completely correct the power factor for your air conditioner, would that save you a significant number of dollars per year in efficiency? And I think the answer is no, because as long as Con Ed or LIPA is not charging you a premium because of your power factor, like they would if it was a great big factory and you're using up 10% of their power, if you know what I mean. You and I are a very small user. As such, they don't like the fact that you might be running a power factor, because you do not have to pay for that. In other words, if the volt amperes that your house is using was equivalent to 10,000 watts of volt amperes, but you're only really using 7,000 watts of real power, the way your watt-hour meter on your house behaves, it will only register the 7,000 watts in my example. The fact that you're using 10,000 volt amperes of apparent power, but 7,000 watts of real power, that difference doesn't cost you anything. You only pay the 7,000 because that's all the watt-hour meter registers. The watt-hour meter is going to tell how much you really use and not what the apparent volt amperes are. So you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to correct for that. So I think you're misinterpreting the capacitor across the line for power factor correction. As a homeowner, I say you don't have to do that, Gabe. KB2MAR, K2RIW.
WS2N.
Okay, so basically, this whole thing is really not going to do anything for me if I try to figure out the value of a capacitor and all that kind of stuff. So it wouldn't be of any benefit. So just leave it the way it is. Because remember, I read someplace that the capacitor, you could get a value of capacitor and put it over the line, or maybe over the compressor itself, but I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't open up the unit and do that. But what you're telling me that the power that they're charging me is what I'm getting. It's not like I have to pay X or anything like that. The meter is calibrated to go at what you're telling me, 70% of the actual power that was given to me. WF-20, I believe it was. Go right ahead.
Yeah, that's true. Let me kill this extra set of audio I got coming out here. If you go to Bernie's site, which is Bernie at HuntFamily.org, and if you're, or is it, I think it's .org, or is it .com? I think it's .org. And there you'll see a week or two ago I put in an article on the subject of how you measure power. It was an article that was in Electronic Design News magazine. The bottom line of all of that is that the watt-hour meters that we have on our house only charge us, only register the amount of real watts you're using. It ignores the volt amperes and only looks at real power. You don't have to correct the power factor at your house. It'd be nice if you could do that, but you don't have to do it. There's no real advantage. You're not going to save any money by doing it. And depending on how you put the capacitor across the line, there's a lot of risk factor in that. In other words, that's got to be done very carefully. It's got to be a high-quality capacitor. I mean, the capacitor itself across the line, if it has a failure, there's a small possibility it can create a fire, it can create a short circuit, it can do damage. So for an average homeowner to try to correct power factor, I strongly recommend you do not do that. I think Paul had something he wanted to say on this, or maybe a further question. WS2N, K2RIW.
And Whiskey has a comment on the subject.